Welcome to this special interview program focused on the use of immunotherapy and new systemic agents in the management of gynecologic cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This special CME activity is a satellite event to the 2020 Society of Gynecologic Oncology virtual meeting. I met via Zoom with the faculty of Drs. Ursula Matalonis, Mike Bierer, Krishna Tiwari, and David O'Malley, who each did slide presentations for an enduring video program, and in the interviews, I explored the issues discussed in these talks. In our lecture series, Dr. Matalonis reviewed the current clinical trial data on the use of checkpoint inhibitors in the management of ovarian cancer, where with the exception of the very small subset with MSI-high disease, treatment has been largely disappointing, not approved by the FDA, and generally not used by investigators outside a clinical trial setting. In my discussion with Dr. Matalonis, however, I asked if there ever would be a situation in which she might consider the use of this treatment strategy outside of a clinical trial.
The times that I will think about use of, let's say, pembrolizumab off of a study would be those patients who are heavily pretreated and they have a good performance status, don't have any contraindications to a single agent checkpoint inhibitor, and really are motivated to try to use this drug, because I think the KEYNOTE 100 trial really showed that it doesn't matter how many prior lines of treatment you've had. So it's not like in chemotherapy where each chemotherapy drug, the response rates drop down. With IOs, it really seems like it doesn't matter if you're 6 lines or you're 1 line, the response rates are going to be probably the same. So it's really in that more heavily pretreated patient population where I think she might be able to tolerate a checkpoint inhibitor and she's motivated and her insurance company will pay for it.
You pointed out at least one data set where with a PD-L1 level, I think over 10%, you saw 17% response rate, which sounds pretty reasonable. What about duration of response? Why is there a hesitation to use this therapy if there's a 17% response rate in that situation?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a few things. One is that the number of patients with combined positive scores of 10 or more actually drops off. So it's a minority of the patient population. It's a pretty small number. And not all pathologists report out combined positive score. They'll report out the PD-L1 positivity of cancer cells, but it's not calculated the same way as in the pembrolizumab data, where you look at all of the cells that are PD-L1 positive over the number of tumor cells. So there's that. So you don't necessarily get that level of information from the pathologist. They'll just say, oh yeah, PD-L1 positivity. Well, but it's probably, you know, you're also incorporating the tumor microenvironment in the CPS score. So I think that's the issue. But I do think it would be great if we could move towards some sort of an FDA approval for this, just to sort of solidify it. You know, there are toxicities associated with these drugs too. And I think that's the other piece that is, most of the toxicities with IO agents, as you know, are pretty early grade or low grade toxicities, but then there can be patients who develop colitis or pneumonitis, some glandular problem. So when the toxicity is bad, it's bad, whereas opposed to chemotherapy, it's more controllable. It's unlikely to be potentially lethal. You know, 2 patients did die on the single agent Pembro trial. One had hypoaldosteronism and the other patient had Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So there can be significant toxicities.
Have you seen a patient who got single agent checkpoint inhibitor with ovarian cancer, who was not MSI high, who had what seemed to be a very good clinical, longer lasting response?
Yes. The patient on the KEYNOTE 100 study, I ended up seeing her, interestingly, as a second opinion, and she was on the trial. And she came to me because she had done so well and she was at the 2-year mark. And a lot of the pembrolizumab trials basically say you've got to come off study at 2 years. And so she was basically saying, could you try to keep me on trial? Her primary oncologist could have kept her on and just written for pembrolizumab, you know, off study. But to my knowledge, she was not MSI high. She was high grade serous carcinoma, certainly not BRCA mutated, nothing unusual or anything that stood out about her histology. So yes, there are patients. And I think that the clear cell patients are also other folks where we don't really understand why those patients maybe do a little bit better. They don't always, not always microsatellite and stable, but they just seem to have better responses consistently.
Interesting. So I want to ask you a couple questions about checkpoint inhibitors and other cancers, get a little bit of your take on that, beginning with endometrial cancer. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you integrate checkpoint inhibitors into the management of the disease?
Mm-hmm. So certainly, as you know, all patients with endometrial cancer will undergo some type of mismatch repair testing. Our hospital does it through MMR-IHC. That's a great way to screen for Lynch, and it also identifies patients who might benefit from a checkpoint inhibitor. So for patients who have recurrent disease, to me, that's a really big distinction. Mismatch repair deficient, mismatch repair proficient. If they're deficient and they've got recurrent disease, right away, I usually start the checkpoint inhibitor after carboplatin paclitaxel. The package insert does say, after all available therapies, then to use the checkpoint blockade. For some reason, the patient refuses carboplatin paclitaxel, or there's just, if there's some contraindication, then I'm okay about using pembrolizumab. And I've had some really remarkable responses. So I absolutely believe that these drugs really can change the natural history of this cancer. In mismatch repair proficient tumors, we are with chemotherapy, and obviously the pembrolizumab lenvatinib approval has come through as well. Tougher regimen, lenvatinib's tougher at a dose of 20 milligrams. So that's always in our back pocket now, and it's nice to have options finally for patients with recurrent endometrial cancer. But I also think that there are other avenues. So for example, if there's a patient with a grade 1 endometrioid tumor and she's got lung metastases and you show that the tumor is estrogen receptor positive, then some type of hormonal therapy can really be quite active as well. You don't really necessarily have to even use chemotherapy. Certainly things like the tamoxifen megase regimen, or if patients can't tolerate the megase, then I'll just use a single agent aromatase inhibitor.
Interesting. You brought up the issue of some of these great responses that you're seeing, and I'm curious about the issue of stopping checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah.
You kind of referred to that with this other patient. But, this comes up in every situation where checkpoint inhibitors are used. There are trials, as you were saying, where this is prescribed. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, outside a protocol setting, do you think about stopping and at what point?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it's still, unfortunately, the rare time where someone's on the drug for such a long period of time where either they don't get disease progression or they don't get some, or they don't get some terrible toxicity that makes you take them off. I have a patient who's had a great response to pembrolizumab, but she's really been life-altered with colitis because of it. And I have a patient right now who came to me truly in a wheelchair because of the level of retroperitoneal adenopathy that she had and pelvic adenopathy. It's been transformative using pembrolizumab. I mean, she's kayaking, she's working, and she's coming up on 2 years. And she really wants to stop. She really wants to stop. So for me, it's basically trying to say, you know what, let's get you to 2 years. Not that that's anything magical. Each scan looks a little tiny bit better. So I'm pushing her to go at least to 2 years and then probably stopping it then, really because she's driving me to stop.
Another question I want to ask you is, just very recently, there was FDA approval of giving pembrolizumab every 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts about that? Is that kind of where you're now heading?
Yeah, I think even if we weren't in the middle of the COVID pandemic, I think bringing patients in for fewer visits, fewer infusions is always a good thing. I have a patient right now who developed pneumonitis, pretty significant pneumonitis because of pembrolizumab, and her pneumonitis is resolved. And our pulmonologist really did not want me to go back because the FDA approval just happened. So he was worried about using a higher dose and maybe risking reactivation of the pneumonitis. But I think, yeah, my lady who's kayaking, who was in a wheelchair, was delighted to hear that she will only have to see me now every 6 weeks as opposed to every 3 weeks. So yeah, no, I think it's a great thing. Patients don't have to come in and see us as often.
I next met with Dr. Beer. To begin, I asked him about an interesting issue he covered in his presentation, a genomic subset in endometrial cancer that was new to me.
So can you talk a little bit more about POLE?
like what cancers do you see it in? How often do you see it? What we know about effective checkpoint inhibitors, and how do you diagnose it? Is it like on an NGS or something?
Well, it's not common. And frankly, I've been somewhat critical of the Cancer Genome Atlas studies because they're very expensive and frequently don't provide us with a lot of new findings. That was one of them. Mutations in POLE had never been described in a tumor setting until it came through on TCGA. It's fairly rare, about 4 to 5%. And POLE is a rare polymerase that actually helps edit the DNA. So it is involved in essentially cleaning up mistakes. So, you know, when you see where it's falling in that spectrum, in that they're called ultra mutated, it makes sense because you're not cleaning up the DNA. So all those mutations just sit there. Now, what you'd predict is that if the DNA is that messed up and you're getting a tumor out of it, that maybe those tumors would be so close to dying by themselves that maybe those patients would do well. And that is, in fact, what the Cancer Genome Atlas found. POLE patients do well no matter what. And that's probably because the tumors are right on the edge of apoptosis. But as I said, it only accounts for 5%. But they also are prime targets for immune checkpoint inhibitors because there are an order of magnitude more mutations in those tumors than they are for mismatch repair. And as you know, mismatch repair abnormal tumors are an order of magnitude above what you see with intact mismatch repair. So they're incredibly mutated. Outside of endometrial cancer, you ask tough questions, Neil. Endometrial cancers, the POLE mutations are most common there. They are found occasionally. I cannot quote you the number. I can tell you this, that we are routinely looking for POLE now in endometrial cancers, but we don't look randomly through other cancers. So they're pretty rare.
That's interesting because you think about colon cancer where you see more mismatch repair, early stage disease, less metastatic.
Yep.
And you were talking about how the POLE inherently dies easier. So I was just wondering.
I think that phenomenon is the same thing,
right,
which is the mismatch repair colorectal cancers grow a little slower because essentially half the cells are apoptosing.
Right.
So I think you're absolutely right on that. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, the Lynch syndrome patients, the sentinel tumor is endometrial cancer. It's not colorectal. Yeah.
Right. So again, in terms of POLE, if you send off like Foundation One, Caris, will they pick that up?
Yeah.
And have you had a patient with metastatic endometrial who had POLE?
You know, I'm sorry to say, we look and look and look, and I have yet to have one. But my colleagues have. I mean, the large volume places are picking them up. I'll tell you another example. It's a little off topic, but we do MSI high testing on all of our ovary patients. It happens in about 1.5% of ovarian cancers have mismatch repair. But because of the association of mismatch repair with tremendous responses to anti-PD-1s, we look.
Anyhow, back to lenvatinib, pembrolizumab. I'm curious what your thoughts are. I always like to ask people about this, about what's going on in terms of mechanism of action. Why is it that an anti-angiogenic, you see it with an antibody like Bev, you see it with TKI like lenvatinib. Any thoughts about what's going on there with the IO?
Yeah, it's a great question. The short answer is I don't think we know. And we sort of got into it, I mean, not to be too shrill about it, but we got into it almost sort of on an empiric basis because agents like Bev and then the IO were available. So people reflexively say, hey, these are two good combinations to throw in and they're not going to have overlapping toxicities. But as I said in my presentation, I do think there are some rationale for that. So for instance, certainly the anti-VEGF therapies, VEGF is a very immunosuppressive agent. And I think we're going to find out that it's even more immunosuppressive than we appreciate it. That doesn't apply to too much to lenvatinib because lenvatinib is working on the receptor level, which is sort of downstream. But you could argue, look at those receptors are sitting on immune cells and the VEGF is interacting. And so it's blocking those. And so maybe it's blocking immune suppressive signals to the T cells. You can't really see me on the screen, I'm waving my hands right now. So there's a certain amount of unknown factors here. But the bottom line is they're off and running. We did the phase 2 trial, single agent of lenvatinib when I was at Harvard. It's an interesting drug. It certainly does have some toxicities. It has a very unusual toxicity in that it can produce significant weight loss. And the weight loss is from appetite suppression. In addition to fatigue, hypertension, and some diarrhea, it does have this unusual weight loss phenomenon, which appears to be an essential toxicity because patients just don't want to eat.
So, you know, it's incredible how many times I've asked people about lenvatinib going back to the HCC days and never heard anybody, even thyroid, I think, never heard anybody bring up the loss of appetite. That is really interesting. Incidentally, are they looking into that as a treatment for obesity or something?
It's interesting. So, first of all, one of the reasons that we may have seen more of it in the phase 1/phase 2 single agent is we went to higher doses. But two, yeah, I actually brought that up a couple of times with a little tongue in cheek, but I think the company's put that on the back burner for now, but not crazy. I've not ever dealt with a drug that had that phenomenon. I had a lovely, lovely patient of mine who was kind of a small, demurring lady who was on single agent for endometrial cancer and was on it for over 2 years, swore by the drug and wouldn't come off. She literally begged me and she lost 30% of her body weight and then finally came off, and it was amazing. Within 3 months, she gained it all back.
Wow. 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 How many times have you seen what you thought was, I mean, I don't know how many times you've even used lenvatinib, but how many times have you seen this phenomenon of the loss of appetite?
Well, in the single agent trial, we saw 30 to 40%.
Wow.
In the combination, we're not seeing it as much. But again, if you look at some of the numbers I presented, the 20 milligram is tough to deal with. I start with 20 milligrams because that's what the FDA approved, and I don't have a problem with. A lot of my colleagues are starting at 14 and going up if they can. I start at 20 and work down. The average dose on that trial ended up to being around 14 milligrams. So, you know, it may be that when you're down in that range, you're seeing some hypertension, some diarrhea, but you're not seeing a lot of the appetite suppression.
Yeah, I just got really, I was about to ask you about a bunch of the other stuff, and I got really diverted when you told me about this weight loss thing. That, do the patients complain of it? Do they not like it? I mean, what do they actually say? Do they stop eating completely? It's not a dysphagia, right?
Correct. That's right. You know, frankly, if I recall correctly, on the phase 2 single agent, they didn't really complain about it. We noticed it from the clinical trial standpoint because weight loss is actually an adverse event, and so you have to quantify this stuff. But it's not like they're nauseous. It's not like they feel uncomfortable. They just don't feel like eating. So,
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does hypertension with this combination actually play out? Do you see symptomatic patients? Is it just that it's hard to control on paper?
Yeah. I think part of that is drug-related, and part of it a little bit is what I would call the lay of the land for oncology. If you remember, gynecologic cancers are a little different in that a lot of our patients are treated both by med-oncs and by gyn-oncs. In the med-onc field, we've been using TKIs. They've been approved quite a bit. And so the hypertension, the fatigue associated with it is something that we've seen and we deal with. It's a little bit newer in gyn-onc. And so I think that that's part of the equation. And that's changing rapidly because a lot of people are using the combination. And as gyn-oncs get comfortable with it, that'll be fine. But the second issue is the drug itself, which is that we're used to hypertension from Bev, right? You give the antibody. The bad news is the antibody has a long half-life. So if you get hypertension, it hangs around for a while. But the good news is it comes on slower. It's rare they have a patient call you up and say, I got a splitting headache and I'm seeing things and I'm in a hypertensive crisis. It's just, if you're on top of your patients, it doesn't happen. For lenvatinib, you can see severe hypertension within 48 to 72 hours. Part of it is probably mechanism of action. Part of it is absorption of the drug and how it gets in very quickly. The good news is, because it's an oral drug, if you hold a drug, it disappears fast. But I do know my colleagues, I'm thinking several of them at Memorial, have just felt that for patients who already have a hypertension or patients who don't, but they're concerned one, they'll actually prescribe either a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker at the time they start them on lenvatinib and Pembro. And then they'll do the usual take your blood pressure at home. So when they get the call saying, yeah, you know, I'm 170 over 110, they don't have to call in a prescription, just say, okay, start the medication. So I find that perfectly acceptable. I'll do it as a reaction, but You got to be aware of this stuff. If you ask the patients what they complain about on lovatinib, you make a good point. Hypertension is something we worry about. They don't really complain too much. It's frankly the diarrhea, because it just makes them uncomfortable. It's about 35% of patients below 10% is grade 3. That makes them feel uncomfortable. And the fatigue is also an issue that they don't like.
Yeah. I don't remember hearing about diarrhea with HCC, but I did, you know, because initially I was like, well, do people feel bad when they get it? And then I started to hear people say, yeah, it's, you know, it's a TKI. They feel fatigued. They have kind of TKI stuff, so to speak. Is that your impression in, let's say, for example, endometrial cancer, when you give lenvatinib pembro, that you're getting some TKI stuff? Do you think that's what the fatigue is?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, if you look really carefully at the phase 2 trial, if you look at discontinuation rates and you ascribe it to drugs, it turns out the discontinuation rate for lovatinib is about the same as pembro. But if you look at the dose interruption, it's twice as high for lovatinib. So what does that tell you? It tells you that they're getting a reaction to it. They don't like it. They get some hypertension, diarrhea. You hold a drug, you adjust the dose, and you're fine. And the discontinuation rate, meaning the really serious stuff, is about the same for both drugs.
I think the other thing that I was trying to figure out is it kind of is sounding like whatever toxicity you get from pembro, you get it, like any other situation. Whatever toxicity from lovatinib, you're getting it. It sounds like maybe there's no synergy between the toxicities. You just deal with them separately, sort of. Or do you think there's actually some synergistic toxicity going on?
Yeah, great question. I don't think there is. I think it's true and unrelated. The only part that's somewhat related is a clinical management standpoint. When you get the diarrhea, right, you've got to make sure that you're dealing with lovatinib-induced diarrhea and not colitis from the pembro, because the ramifications of that is really quite different. And so I usually score it in terms of severity, and of course I look for blood. And anything that suggests continued diarrhea holding lovatinib or bloody diarrhea, then they go to a scope and you're looking at potentially a pembro-induced problem. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't see synergistic interactions or toxicities. And I think a lot of it has been a learning curve in terms of how do you handle this, because it's been a new experience. But remember, this is the irony on this. What was our drug of choice prior to the development of this regimen? It was doxorubicin. You want to give adriamycin to an obese, diabetic, hypertensive woman. Not easy. And the response rate was considerably lower. So this is a huge step forward, even with the toxicities.
Yeah, it's really amazing being in CME, you know, topics that we couldn't find anything to talk about, like bladder cancer. Bladder cancer. They got two novel agents approved. Bladder cancer, you know, so interesting times. Anyhow, so a couple other things, just sort of practical issues about checkpoint inhibitors. Are you using checkpoint inhibitors outside of clinical trial setting in patients with ovarian cancer other than MSI high?
No, I'm not. So again, MSI high is the exception, and I think there's a rationale on that. The rest of the track record has been sort of dismally disappointing. The response rates to single agents has been between 9 and 12%. And I think we've hammered that home. The future of immune checkpoint inhibitors in ovary, I think, will be either combinations with other drugs like PARP inhibitors or potentially antiangiogenics, or combinations of IO agents. And so you're seeing a lot of those trials come through. But that was an interesting story, I think. And what it tells us is that, look, it just because you have a DNA repair abnormality, not all DNA repair abnormalities are the same. It's not like you're producing neoantigens from cigarette smoke. You're producing large shifts of DNA from these Fanconi pathway abnormalities, BRCA1, BRCA2, and they don't create the mutations as well. And so you don't get the response rate. It's been disappointing, but it's just reality.
So I want to also ask you about cervical cancers and immunotherapy. I'm curious, have you seen patients with cervical cancer who clearly had significant clinical benefit, long duration, et cetera, responses to IOs?
So I think the interesting story in cervix is, right, you know, there was a trial, the FDA approval. If you look at PD-L1 positivity, it's a 14% response rate. If it's all comers, it's 12%. So PD-L1 is not a great marker, but the response rate for a viral induced tumor is shockingly low. The question is, why are all those other tumors not responding? And so it's raised the issue, and again, there's a little hand waving here, is that could it be that the chemo rads that all these patients get disrupts basically the blood vessels and the flow of the immune cells into the tumor so that when they recur, you're getting a much lower response rate to single agent, and that will get a much better response as we bring it up front. So there's a huge push to bring the immune checkpoint inhibitors up front in cervix, and I support that, and I think that makes sense. You got a 14% response rate, but at least those patients respond, and they have a huge duration of response. I mean, it goes well over a year for patients who would effectively be dead within 2 to 3 months. So the duration response for that 12 to 14% is long.
Do you see patients who have recurrent cervical cancer, get single agent pembro, their PD-1's better, and really do well? You know, I'm not saying a total home run, 5 years or anything, but, you know, respond or do not progress within a year, even if it's 12%. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So the data is, as I said, that was in cervix, low response rate, but those patients who do respond do well. I've had one patient who, by all measures, recurred from cervical cancer, had a lot of periaortic nodes, and I believe she had upper abdominal disease also. Status post standard of care, including GOG-240, which is a Bev-containing regimen. If you look at GOG-240, those patients who progress live roughly 1 to 2 months, very short, after they recur from standard of care GOG-240. This patient is out a year on single agent pembro and still doing well. So yeah, it's not as common as we'd like, but those patients do very well.
I next met with Dr. Tewari, and to begin, I asked him about his approach to sequencing of systemic therapies in metastatic cervical cancer.
So with these patients in the frontline setting, you know, I always look for a trial. And if I don't have a trial, standard of care is chemo plus bevacizumab. However, we have to also realize that bevacizumab may not be effective or confer a survival benefit in low-risk patients. Bevacizumab in the previously treated patient comes with the risk of fistula formation. So there is one of the objectives of the GOG-240 trial with bevacizumab was to try to identify who is high-risk, mid-risk, and low-risk. And what we showed, the patients that are low-risk by virtue of not having pelvic disease, not having had prior platinum, not having a performance status greater than 1, not having had a short disease-free interval from time to recurrence, and not being socioeconomically disadvantaged. Those patients that don't have any of those 5 clinical prognostic factors, the benefit seen with bevacizumab is minuscule. So what I do is a patient with recurrent disease, I calculate their MOR score, M-O-O-R-E. We published it in Clinical Cancer Research after GOG-240 was mature. And if their MOR score, if they have 0 or 1 of those factors, we consider them low risk and we offer them chemotherapy with the bevacizumab, but we tell them that there may not be a survival advantage, but there's the 6 to 8% fistula risk. If they've got a score of 2 to 3, and again, the 5 prognostic factors are short disease-free interval, pelvic disease, prior platinum with radiation, socioeconomic disadvantaged, and performance status greater than 1. If they have 2 or 3 of those factors, there is a survival benefit observed with bevacizumab. And certainly 4 or 5 factors, there's a stronger survival benefit. So I counsel patients and I put them on carboplatin because they've had cisplatin with their radiation, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab if there isn't a clinical trial available for the patient that relapses after cisplatin-based chemo radiation.
And what's next?
After that, then they progress. I check their PD-L1 status. If they got a PD-L1 positive tumor, they can get pembrolizumab. If they don't, I can offer them participation in the cemiplimab study. And beyond that, we now have antibody drug conjugates that are being studied in the phase 3 setting. Tisotumab vedotin is a drug that uses tissue factor, monoclonal antibody against tissue factor, and it has a linker that's connected to a payload. So it's almost like a Trojan horse or a suicide bomber or a warhead. So the tissue factor antibody binds to the cancer cell that expresses tissue factor receptor. The cancer cell internalizes the antibody with its payload, which is the drug, and the drug kills the cell. So we're studying that.
So just a couple other questions. One, we've seen throughout oncology studies looking at VEGF TKIs plus IO. Obviously, you have an endometrial, lenvatinib, pembro, and this renal, that kind of strategy. Has that been looked at in cervical, and do you think it makes sense to look at?
I think it does. So Brad Monk at U.S. Oncology in Creighton University in Arizona, he did a randomized phase 2 study of pazopanib versus lapatinib, pazopanib being an oral TKI anti-angiogenesis drug, and showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival in cervix against lapatinib, which is essentially anti-EGF. And so I think lenvatinib, cedirinib's been studied in the UK. Dr. Simmons, I believe, was the first author of the CIRCA trial, C-I-R-C-A. It was a randomized phase 2 carboplatin paclitaxel with or without cedirinib, and it showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival in cervix, and more importantly, objective response was 65%, I think, which is even higher than with bevacizumab. And so the idea of combining immunotherapy with anti-angiogenesis is very attractive because we know that VEGF, which is the target of, for example, bevacizumab, VEGF is immunosuppressive in the tumor microenvironment. It makes T cells not work very well. It attenuates the response of dendritic cells. And so targeting VEGF with anti-angiogenesis therapy may make immunotherapy more effective. So I love that idea, studying the two of them together.
You mentioned the antibody drug conjugate to sotrovimab, vedotin. Have you actually given it to any patients on trial?
Yeah, we have a couple patients enrolled at this point at UC Irvine. Because the linker is felt to be responsible for some of the ocular toxicity that is seen, patients see an ophthalmologist first. They're using eye drops and the patients are doing well. I don't know if they're getting the drug or not because these are placebo-controlled studies. But we've got two patients on trial.
You remind me a little bit. I know there are ocular problems.
It's more like dry eyes. It's more of dry eyes. But as you can understand, Neil, anytime you talk about side effects that involve eyes to patients, patients get very understandably uncomfortable. So it's very important that we counsel them very carefully. In the studies, the phase 2 studies that have been done with this drug, there was only one very serious ocular toxicity that didn't resolve. Everyone else, it's been limited and resolved. But it's very important to use the eye drops, very important to see the ophthalmologist before enrolling on the study or before getting treated.
So these two patients, even though you don't know what they were on, neither of them had eye problems?
Not so far. We just activated the trial maybe in February. And again, with COVID and everything, you know, our cancer center made a decision that all the treatment trials can continue. But also, it's been a little hard to get patients to come in. And so we're just slowly ramping things up. But I think we'll be able to probably put quite a few patients on that study.
Do you think right now the best place to use that would be either somebody who's PD-L1 negative, who you were going to give, you know, a second line therapy, or somebody after getting pembro? Would that be a logical next step?
I think so. And my paradigm is if they're eligible for the trial, I'm going to recommend that trial before I recommend anything else that's off study, because these trials are really well designed with tisotumab vedotin. And I think the objective response in heavily pretreated patients in the phase 2 is probably 31 to 33%, maybe even as high as 34%. So it's a promising agent. All these agents are promising. We just hope that they result in some clinically meaningful benefit.
The final investigator I met with was Dr. O'Malley, whose module focused on new agents in gynecologic cancer, including tisotumab vedotin, an antibody-drug conjugate with encouraging clinical activity with relatively few adverse events that include conjunctivitis. This agent targets tissue factor, which accounts for its anti-tumor activity, but also on-target toxicities.
So normal tissue factor is really ubiquitous in the submembrane. And so that is actually one challenge with it, but it seems to be overexpressed in multiple cancers. So as we look at this as a standpoint of a vascular impact, for example, we see the epistasis. this inflammation in the conjunctiva is really interesting. And I don't think I can do justice as to why that happens. It's very different than the eye toxicities we see in other ADCs. We don't see this conjunctivitis in the other ADCs.
What other cancers is tissue factor seen in? Are any of these being looked at with this agent?
Yeah, they have multiple trials ongoing. Obviously, I'm more familiar with the ones in the GYN, but we talked about the ovarian cancer one, cervix cancer. I believe they're looking at lung and potentially pancreatic.
I was really interested by some of the new trial concepts that are being looked at with TV, including combination strategies. And I'm kind of curious if you have a favored one.
It's a great question, Neil. My favorite, having an agent where we could utilize in the first line setting to potentially limit alopecia and yet still have an active is one of probably the more exciting, even combined with carboplatin. We haven't yet moved to the triplet, carboplatin, TV, Bev, but I think that it would obviously be very interesting in the future. So could you substitute this in the first line treatment? That to me is the more exciting.
Yeah, I was kind of flashing. Obviously, we talk a lot about brentuximab vedotin in our lymphoma programs. And, you know, I know it's a different agent, but in terms of strategy there, you know, it is used first line Hodgkin and peripheral T cell right now, combined with chemotherapy. So interesting to see this playing out in gynecologic cancers. I'm kind of curious, have you seen patients who you can say had clearly clinically meaningful benefit from TV?
Yeah, actually, we've had some really nice results and have a patient where we continue to see a benefit. Obviously, protect confidentiality, I don't want to say more than that. But not only do we see partial response, but sustained partial response. We see that from the original reports in the first in human trials. So there clearly is clinical benefit here. What's the best way and the best dosing and those mitigation strategies? We're going to continue to learn more about this drug.
One of the things that always fascinated me about Bevacizumab and Hodgkin is that there's a subset of patients who not only go into CR, but some of them, like really long CRs, they even talk about cure with Hodgkin's, and they have no idea how to separate them out. Any predictors here that you've seen?
And I was just going to say, that's one of the more frustrating, you know, because it is so widely expressed, I would love to be able to have a better biomarker to really identify those patients who are going to benefit. That work continues and is ongoing. And I think as we see this long-term follow-ups in these patients, my hope is that we would be able to identify those patients with a biomarker who are going to benefit the most. But we don't have that this time.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the Ipi-Nivo thing and just that whole strategy of anti-CTLA-4 and PD-1 in gynecologic cancers. I know this comes up in other cancers. You're seeing a lot of Pembro used right now, second line for cervical. In a younger patient who's in good condition, would you ever consider something like Ipi-Nivo in somebody who already had Pembro, for example?
Let me start with the first question with regards to the results. And, you know, as we look at the single agent Pembro response, it's really consistent, 10% plus or minus 5%, maybe 15%, very consistent, about 14.7%. So as we're seeing doubling or even tripling that response rate, yes, they're modest, but you're seeing a much improved over single agent Pembro. The question then becomes, would you reintroduce combination immune therapy in a patient who had already been exposed to Pembro? Yes, I would. You know, I think we need to answer that question when we start to study these combination immune therapies in the future. We really need to look at a subgroup who are previously treated. As we saw in the CheckMate trial, those who had, without any prior systemic therapy, benefited the most. The next question to ask, would I feel comfortable substituting combination immune therapy in place of combination cytotoxic? I don't think we're there yet. We really need clinical trials to answer that question. With the clear survival advantage of the platinum doublet with Bev, with the survival advantage compared to a platinum doublet, I really think that continues to be the standard.
So just to clarify, though, about Ipi-Nivo, in terms of the idea of using it in somebody who had prior Pembro with cervical cancer, are you saying that's something that you would consider outside a trial setting, or that more is a clinical trial concept?
No, I would consider that outside. The options for these patients, the second or third line, are just not there. Anything exciting is not there. So would I, outside of clinical trial? Yes. Would I ideally like to do that as part of a clinical trial? Well, you know me in clinical trials. I always want to enroll on and to answer those questions.
I know there's other anti-CTLA-4 PD-1 combinations. There's tremelimumab and durvalumab I've seen. Any others that are out there or being looked at?
Yeah, I think the most mature is a small company called Agenus. And I'm honored to be the PI on a randomized prospective two-arm phase 2 trial, which is looking at their single agent PD-1 inhibitor plus or minus their CTLA-4. So everybody gets the PD-1. And then half the patients in a blinded fashion will get the CTLA-4. They've actually completed two single arm trials that enrolled 150 patients. So we should be seeing those results shortly. So obviously the single agent continues to have modest response rates, but we hope that the combination in this trial will see some real improvements in these outcomes of the patients.
You know, another thing that's kind of hard for us on the outside to get a real feel for is the difference between checkpoint inhibitors. And of course, we've been asking that since the beginning. Now there's like six or who knows how many approved. And we keep hearing back, it's hard to separate them out, PD-1, PD-L1. But then you see stuff like with dostarlimab, and I look at that and I go, is that different? So are there any out there that are different? You know, you see, I mean, I know there's small series, but like you see MS stable endometrial responding. Do you think there's a difference between these PD-1 agents?
Well, I talk to my melanoma and lung cancer colleagues a lot, and they've given a lot more immune therapy than I have, and they're not able to identify clear differences. I think we look for outliers in efficacy and toxicity. We don't see it. We all have personal experiences, and when you're looking at severe toxicities of the 5% range, if you have a couple of those in a row, it can really skew the way you look at a drug. So that's why it's so important to really look at these collectively. And I just can't differentiate the agents right now in GYN cancers on efficacy or toxicity.
A couple other things that you were talking about in your talk, I wanted to follow up on the HER2 thing. So first of all, what percent of patients are HER2 positive, and how do you define HER2 positive with endometrial cancer?
So the percentage of patients who are HER2 positive of serous cancer of the uterus is probably about the 40% range, very rare in non-serous. Okay. If we look at the population of ovarian cancer in HER2 new, that number is significantly lower and probably much less than 10%, even less than 5%. So how do we define HER2 new positive? It's a great question. Right now, it's the breast cancer data with IHC, and then if it's 2+, then we send for FISH is being utilized, but that needs to be standardized in non-breast cancer patients.
So it's interesting for the general medical oncologist, see how you start out with breast cancer, then we had gastric cancer, then we have colon cancer, which is like different. They approach it differently. And then now we've got serous cancer of the endometrium. And the three of them use the chemo plus trastuzumab. The thing that's sort of out there is more the colon cancer. It's kind of interesting to see whether it's ever going to come together.
It's become standard in anybody with advanced serous cancer of the uterus at our institution. We test for HER2 new. So outside of clinical trial and advanced stage patients, I'll use it in combination with cytotoxic indefinitely. In recurrent setting, if they have not previously progressed on it and it was not tested, I'll ask for it to be tested. And if positive, I'll use even single agent trastuzumab.
So what about other agents, actually HER2 positive lung cancer or mutant cancer you've heard about? What about other anti-HER agents in colon? I've seen them try pertuzumab, which is kind of interesting, which you don't see in the other ones. TDM1 would be something that's used in breast cancer. Also, you're an antibody drug conjugate person. Not only you have TDM1, but you have this new one, trastuzumab deratuxan in HER2 positive. And it looks like it maybe works in HER2 low. So what about all these strategies in endometrial?
We would love to test all of those potential agents in combination, really combination, which we're seeing in breast cancer, obviously. the challenge is it's such a rare tumor. And then to take half of those patients or more than half of those patients out of the potential groups, it's a very challenging patient population to study. I do believe we will continue to see that as more and more preclinical data supports these regimens. And where do we go ultimately? Combination and or novel agents, because as I mean, pretty impressive on some of our other solid tumors and the response rates.
So I want to flip back to immunotherapy and gynecologic cancers and first chat with you a little bit about your experience in terms of tolerability and autoimmune problems that you've observed in patients and how you think they contrast to checkpoint inhibitor use in so many other different cancers. What do you see in your patients? It seems like I would think that a lot of your experience at this point, at least outside of trial setting, would be endometrial cancer.
So we had a meeting about 2 years ago, and I had said that the occurrence of immune-associated toxicities was significantly higher than the other people on the stage on that day. And my answer was based on the literature outside of GYN cancers. I believe that practitioners who treat GYN cancers have not been as exposed to the toxicity as much as our other solid tumor colleagues because they don't work as well. So they're not on therapy as long, and thus you're not seeing as many toxicities. If somebody's only on treatment for 2 cycles, you're not going to see toxicities. So when we're looking at these toxicities, we really need to look at larger populations of patients and not just rely on our own expertise because of the rarity of most of them. So most of my experience has been on clinical trial, which we are one of the highest enrollers of most clinical trials in ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, and cervix cancer. So that experience is wide, but I've treated a fair amount of patients off of clinical trial in uterine as well as cervical cancer patients.
I'm curious what your experience is. I was talking with Mike Bierer about this with the lenvatinib pembrolizumab combination. It seems like it's very effective. Is that your experience, incidentally, with, say, MS-stable endometrial cancer? What have you seen in terms of its, I don't know how many people you might have treated, its efficacy, but also its tolerability and side effects issues?
So lenvatinib pembro, I call it LEM-PEM, is a really nice option for our stable, microsatellite stable patients. And the efficacy is significantly improved over what else we have on the table. The interesting aspect is we're also seeing long-term responders like we do in the MSI-high patients with the single agent, pembro. But the tolerability is a challenge with regards to lenvatinib, in addition to the other autoimmune disease toxicities. I should say autoimmune toxicities, excuse me. So the lenvatinib definitely has a learning curve. Very important to be diligent, close monitoring. We now have weekly visits for the first month to two with our patients, now that we can do remote visits. Hypertension, GI, and fatigue. If you start a patient at full dose, which is the 20 milligrams, you expect about 80% will be dose reduced. Many practitioners have taken that and they're starting a lower dose. But, you know, I'm worried about the importance of trying to get the higher dose in at the beginning. I think there's something to that. We'll have to see more data to try to figure that out. I often use 18 milligrams rather than 20 milligrams, but I'm using that more for pragmatic reasons, which is when you use the 18 milligram dose, you get 10s and 4s. And so if I have to dose reduce the patient, it's much easier for me to dose reduce them because they already have the 4 milligram tab. If I give the 20 milligrams, then I have to reduce them to 10. And I just said I'm concerned about dose intensity, so I don't want to do that. So I usually start patients with 18 milligrams for those reasons.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special interview program to a satellite meeting of the 2020 Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting.